Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Happy weekend to you all, and welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, and I am so glad that you have joined us for this hour of child-centric content, where we're going to highlight some of your questions, some trending news, and we've got a fascinating interview this week from author Jonathan Pageau, who's going to talk about why fairy tales are secondary to scripture when it comes to talking about timeless truths. But as always, we are going to kick things off with just a touch of Bible time. I've been going through the book of Exodus, endlessly fascinating. And I got to the portion where the Lord is ready to literally speak the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel. And he sets up some very distinct bounds, some boundaries for the people. He says, "Take heed of yourselves that you do not go up to the mountain or touch its base. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death." And, you know, I read this as a young Christian, and I was like, oh, dang, that is so harsh. Holy cow, like, you just touch the mountain and you have to be put to death. And the older I get and the more I learn, the more I'm like, wow, there is nothing like enforced boundaries, especially as a parent. Obviously, we are constantly laying down rules for our kids, and we want to be wise about what rules we establish. But what I have learned is better to have fewer rules that are consistently enforced than a variety of rules that you ignore when they are transgressed. And obviously, this is a pattern that is set out for us by God himself. Why? Because it is so critical to human formation, especially child formation. It is integral to teaching them and training them to have established boundaries that are consistently, and I'd say lovingly, enforced. The importance of boundaries needs to override our feelings. They are not optional. It is very important for us to communicate that there are bounds within which we need to live if we are going to not only become healthy citizens, but be able to honor the Lord. So this is God the Father modeling some good parenting for us. We're going to talk about some trending news. As always, as regularly, I've got my executive director, Josh Wood, here to help. He is also a parent of three young children. Josh, comments on boundaries. Tell us what you think.
Well, it's easy for us today to look back and say, what a silly arbitrary rule. But I challenge people to just remember that even as the Bible talks about moving from milk to solid food spiritually, God was also teaching big concepts through some of these boundaries that he laid down, including, you know, we even the sacrificial system. You know, there's a lot of theology done around God teaching people about the future through the sacrificial system as well, and tithing being something that teaches people that your short-term sacrifices here, not placing the everything you get, this bounty, 100% of it, not taking all of it for yourself, but dedicating some to God, helps you to store up for the future, which is such a helpful, even in humanity, it's such a helpful characteristic we needed later in life, that you can kind of see through the Israelites' time in the desert too. I think God's teaching them bigger truths as well, that there are set apart things, there are holy things. You need to obey me even when you don't understand all these rules, because it'll benefit you later down the road, even if you can't see the wisdom in it right now. And it does seem like a really harsh consequence, but what you get in the end is people choosing God's way over anything else, even when it, you know, they can't see the fruit of that immediately.
Yeah, when you understand that not just the boundary, but the boundary giver is good, then you can trust the boundary, even if it doesn't always make sense or you don't immediately know why you need to be complying. We're going to turn our attention to some Thanksgiving-related news. We are just on the other side of Thanksgiving, and I hope you had a wonderful time with your family, with your friends, and that it was a time of genuine gratitude. Aquinas said that gratitude is one of the chief virtues, and it's incredible that we have a national holiday to celebrate that specifically. So I wanted to turn our attention to our first story, which talks about how there's a bit of a trend, and it's probably been building over the last couple of years, but we're seeing it very starkly, especially post-election, that Thanksgiving dinner should be a politics-free zone. And for those that are concerned about being with family members or friends who might have voted differently, they are opting to skip the Thanksgiving meal altogether. Josh, do you want to hit some of these highlights that are showing us that some people would rather opt out of one of the most important holidays for joining your heart and giving thanks together with your family in the name of politics?
This is a funny headline, and you had a piece from MSNBC, one from Fox. They're all talking about this idea, should we be cutting off our family members who voted the other way? I think there is something really, really foundational to what's being said, though. We risk here cutting off people who don't think like us and furthering our isolation, our silos. We already have very siloed media, right? You pop on Fox, you pop on MSNBC. It doesn't matter. You're going to get everything you want to hear 24/7. That's how they make their money. They're going to outrage you. They're going to scare you. They're whatever. And so you get on these different, you know, channels, and pick on MSNBC for a second, but they had someone on there that said, people who have voted in ways that are against you, it might be essential for your mental health to skip Thanksgiving or to not invite someone else. I think we are at a critical moment where it is not that people disagree with the good faith opinion that others have when it comes to critical issues like abortion or immigration, etc. We're at a point where people don't even understand how someone could come to that conclusion. And that's very different. That's an escalation I've seen the last couple of years. And that scares me. Things like this make it worse.
Absolutely. It is so important to have exposure to people that disagree with us for several reasons. Number one, it actually forces us to evaluate what we think. Are we right? Do we have blind spots? Are there areas that I'm not seeing clearly? If you're never exposed to somebody who disagrees with you, especially somebody that you trust and that you're in a relationship with, there's a really good chance that we are going to veer off course in terms of our worldview. But the other thing that's so important about these genuine interactions with people that disagree with us is it is much easier to dehumanize somebody that you have no contact with. And that certainly is the case with, I think we saw a lot of it leading up to the election, the degradation of an entire voting block of being racist or sexist or homophobic or whatever it is, if they choose to vote a certain way. And if you actually encounter people and ask them what they think and realize those are not actually the motivations, it's much harder to say and believe those kinds of dismissive remarks. And that's a polite way of putting it. So coming together is so critical. Brad Wilcox, who's a sociologist at the University of Virginia, says all of these different commentators, and we've got a variety, we've got, you know, a Spruce survey that says that nearly 60% of people worry about political disagreements over Thanksgiving. 50% say just want to ban political conversations altogether. You know, there's a Huffington Post piece, you know, where a woman says, you cannot go see your friends and family. I personally will not be in a room of 15 people who voted for Trump. And Brad Wilcox notes, this kind of mentality, it actually reflects cult behavior. If you are taking this advice from people saying you cannot be in a room or in relationship with people that do not affirm and endorse your worldview and your perspective, you very well might be falling into a mindset that is cultish. And so I think that that's a good way of thinking about it. If you're listening to sources that say you cannot be around, you cannot listen to something that does not reflect, validate, and endorse your worldview, there's a real good chance that it might not be a legitimate perspective. You really might be in sort of a cult-like environment.
Well, Katie, I'd love to hear, I've got a couple examples of this, but I'd also love to hear how living in Seattle has shaped your perspective. Obviously, not everyone in Seattle, Washington thinks like you do, but I've got two examples of people very different than myself who came across, came through life experiences on very specific issues. One was immigration. Someone who I'm very close with was one of the last choppers out of Vietnam and came to the United States as a humanitarian parolee, which is a now abused program that President Biden has used to get many, many people into the country legally, but also without really the consent of any legislative body. And her explaining to me what a lifeline that program was did shape and change the way I talked about that program, even if I thought it was currently being abused. The second one was abortion. Another friend of mine who was raped and chose to abort the child. Again, just the way she explained how she processed that decision. And again, this is horrific. And my personal view on this is that it is a life, and we shouldn't punish the child for one other person's sin, which is a grievous sin. But her explaining to me in real terms, again, being in proximity, her talking through how I understood how she came to the decision she did, even if I thought in no circumstances should it have been the decision she made. But it was helpful for me, and it did help me to understand her and show empathy and compassion. So again, I think the farther we drive ourselves, if we pick everyone out of our life that has a differing worldview than us, that is not good or healthy for our ability to reach people.
Yeah, your ability to reach people, your ability to be well-informed, your ability to extend empathy, which even if we politically disagree with somebody, it's really important to be empathetic from where they're coming from. Kind of my overall rule in Seattle is do think through, evaluate your positions, have those conversations, and then plant your feet firmly. And then in general, I don't start the arguments, but I do want to be ready if somebody else starts the argument to be able to respond with both truth and conviction and compassion. I want to turn our attention to one more new bit of research that has come out, and that is that saying thank you really matters. Science shows that it's the secret weapon for family happiness. And I was reading through this study and the summary of the data after just nursing a kid back to health who had the flu. My tall 17-year-old son was absolutely laid out over the last couple of days, completely dependent, it was a flu, terrible, terrible flu. And I would, bring him orange juice and make him bone broth and rub his back and bring him tea. And with his weak little voice, he couldn't even sit up in bed, but I would leave the room and he'd go, "Thanks, Mom." And I was like, wow, this is really affecting me. Just his verbal gratitude, even though he is miserable right now, even in the midst of, this sicky house, it created this real sweetness. And my kids tend to we're close and they're grateful anyway. But I was like, I really, even before I read this study, I'm like, that has a real effect on me. Him just saying thank you to me, it warms my heart. So Josh, what do you think about some of these points that this study found about the importance of saying thank you and how it reinforces kind of family mental health?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you go down through this article, it talks just a lot about how stuff we kind of intuitively know. People who are grateful feel better. People who you say thank you to will feel appreciated. They'll be more positive. It improves mental health. I think it probably just shows how negative we are as a culture that saying something as simple as thank you is going to make an appreciable difference on things like happiness, positivity, and mental health. I mean, it's almost become vogue, especially on, Instagram, Facebook, just to talk about how miserable your life is all the time, how hard kids are, how terrible our husband is, how difficult my job is. Instead of just at a base, just focusing on things that are positive, focusing on things that are good, as scripture teaches us to set our mind on things above. And so I do think this is an area where Christians can lead the way to find the good, to communicate the good, to set a good example of gratitude, and even in very hard circumstances, because there are people with way worse situations than us who find a way to be very grateful for what they have. I think we should be setting an example for culture, and as it pertains to family and kids, man, can we set a great positive example for the world in that too?
Yeah, well, we need to be living it and showing gratitude. And the study talks about how one way, if you feel like your kids aren't grateful, you can model it between husband and wife. Like if you're saying, thank you, I so appreciate that. Wow, I saw that you carved out time of your day to, replace the windshield wipers on my car. I'm just so thankful for that. Model it so that your kids see what they can become, and then we can reveal it to the world, which does need these positive examples. We're wrapping up here. Stay tuned for a fascinating interview with Jonathan Pageau.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're always so grateful that you give us 1 hour of your time on the weekend to think about what is happening in the world through the lens of putting kids first. And today we are going to be speaking with my friend Jonathan Pageau about a new project that he is working on that seeks to prioritize kids and shine a light on some of their fundamental needs, but doing it in a somewhat unconventional way. Well, actually, let me rephrase that. Something that is hyper-conventional, a way that we've been speaking to children, directing children, seeking to inculcate values in children, maybe longer than any other medium. So we're going to talk about his new project today to revivify some of the greatest fairy tales that we have been telling children for centuries. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
It's great to talk to you, Katie.
Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
And so I am an artist. I make traditional art for churches, but I have also written several stories in the past, plays, you know, in I'm just a creative person in general, interested also in ancient stories, ancient mythology, and especially Bible stories. And so now we've set ourselves to revivify the fairy tales, because a lot of the people that have been holding the fairy tales for the past few generations have decided to drop them because they're too cynical. They tell them in these dark kind of twists. And so we think it's time now to take those fairy tales back and to tell them in a celebratory tone that's beautiful, beautifully illustrated, you know, and that especially creates a moment that parents can have with their children. It's such a simple thing that we can do. The bedtime story is a ritual that everybody can participate in. It's not strange at all. And so we're trying to create these very beautifully illustrated books, like almost treasure objects that a parent can sit with their child, you know, before putting them to bed and give them this moment of attention and also connect them to all these ancient stories.
Yeah, I've seen a copy of Snow White, and the illustrations are beautiful. And, you know, part of what we talk about at Them Before Us, especially in those early kind of grammar phases of child development, birth to 10, you want to maximize children's exposure to the good, true, and the beautiful. And these kinds of story tales really are beautiful. And I mean, like, I was a consumer of a lot of kids' books when my kids were younger. And some of the illustrations are like, this is garbage. Like, if I can do it, this is not art. But your illustrations are beautiful. They reveal incredible beauty. So I really appreciate that about it. Tell us, you've completed Snow White. Like, that was kind of the introduction to this new way of telling fairy tales. Where can people purchase that? Like, is it available everywhere?
So for now, it's only on our Shopify store. People can go to thesymbolicworld.com and go to the store. And the reason is because we've actually had offers from publishing companies to publish these fairy tales for us, but we want to have absolute control. I am an artist. I want this to be beautiful. I don't want to compromise on anything, on the number of illustrations or on the way in which we're telling the stories. And so we've decided to keep control over the project and to make them just these absolutely stunning, stunning objects.
Yeah, it really is. So I want to talk a little bit about why fairy tales. I remember I listened to an interview that you did with somebody recently. I can't remember, but you talked about, I think you said something like, next to the Bible, fairy tales are one of the most powerful ways of communicating truth and morality. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I would say that fairy tales are the closest thing to scripture stories that aren't scripture stories. Mm-hmm. And especially for kids, they actually embody some of the patterns that we find in the Bible. That's some of the story patterns that we find in the Bible. But they do it in a way that's usually a little more fantastical. And it also has certain types of images that are maybe more salient for children. And so because of that, they're very precious to us, because some of the stories in the Bible for little kids, they're difficult. They're difficult mm-hmm. to understand. They're also difficult because they deal with subjects that are maybe a little too mature for them. But the fairy tales, not all the fairy tales, but at least the ones that are very popular and that are remembered by everyone, they have a capacity to capture a child's imagination. And when you're doing that and you're telling that story to the child, you know that you are putting in them patterns of thinking, patterns of attention, and patterns of memory that are in tune with what you'll find in the Bible.
Yeah. So I think that unfortunately, a lot of the ways that we expose children to these fairy tales is through Disney. Yep. Right, Disney has captured, and I would say adulterated, so many of these classic stories. I mean, maybe not so much in the 50s and 60s and 70s, like with Pinocchio and maybe the original Snow White. But as we have progressed, they have, I think, you know, had a moral overhaul of a lot of the kind of core messages of the original fairy tales towards something that really deviates from probably the kind of truth that has been distilled down through the generations and through the centuries. So since you have published Snow White, I want to hear from you. What are the major of that, of what you have captured, which I imagine is somewhat close to, I don't want to say the original Snow White, because I imagine that it's gone through a few different manifestations, but the one that was crystallized and captured as it was filtered through a variety of storytellers through the ages, what are the main moral lessons or truths that you feel like kids are going to be able to glean from the fairy tale of Snow White that you just published?
So one of the things about fairy tales that's amazing is that in some ways they are, because they are so ancient, we don't even know how old they are. They're retold by mothers, by grandmothers, you know, to their children, but not even only to children, but even to adults. Fairy tales are actually also for grownups. And because of that, they embody the pattern of memory, is a good way to understand it, is that there are no authors of fairy tales. They basically have been told and retold and remembered and refined over the centuries. And so you can have a kind of confidence that the story, the reason why it was remembered and retold and people cared about it, means that it is saying something true about human nature, even if you don't know what that is. Okay. And so the story, for example, of Snow White is so dense. It is very much similar to a scripture story. It has all these very, very potent elements in it. And what you can do when you tell the story is that without distorting it, without changing it, you can make certain things brighter and things that are more relevant to the moment now. So a simple example in our version of Snow White, we emphasize the queen looking into the mirror and becoming obsessed with the mirror telling her how beautiful she is. And instead of having a mirror on the wall, we have her hold a mirror in her hand. And when you see the illustration, you can see that it's a phone for all intents and purposes. And she becomes obsessed with, you know, receiving her credibility from the phone, but also the mirror telling her that she's not beautiful enough and that driving her into despair. And so, you know, it really is the Snow White story. We didn't change the story at all, but just by slightly kind of emphasizing certain things, we are making it more relevant for the modern world and for the people that will be reading it now.
Yeah, well, and obviously, those of you that followed Them Before Us Radio know that we are battling a mental health crisis in the younger generation, especially young girls who are often receiving messages, especially through social media and the algorithms that accompany social media apps, that they are not beautiful, that they need to use filters to be acceptable to the world, that they need to conform to some kind of superficial standard or unrealistic standard if they're going to be accepted by society. And so obviously you can see these timeless truths have been around for a long time. And like you said, like they have been distilled and concentrated in a way that are going to reflect a reality about human nature across time. So one of the other things that I loved about your version of Snow White was the detail, even a lot of the different imagery that I was like, that seems like a detail that I'm like, why did they put that in there? Like the presence of crows, you know, and I was like, tell me about the crows. Like, what are the crows there for? What do they mean?
Yeah, well, in the story, so one of the things too we liked about the way we did it is there are some details of the story which are actually not written in the text. So we actually interplay between the images and the text. And so there are some things you discover through the images, for example, that aren't even written in the story. And I just wanted that deep experience so that the child can go back, or even the grown-up can go back. There's certain insights in the story that are there even for adults that you can go back and get, oh, wait, this is more, there's more going on in this story than what I thought. And so the crow, in some ways, because the story of Snow White really does have to do with, let's say, changing death into life. You know, that's really what the story is about. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with the death of the mother, but also in some ways the death of the girl's childhood. You know, it is a coming of age story. The story is about puberty to some extent. It's not just about that, but there is an aspect of the story which is about a young girl becoming a woman and all the difficulties and challenges that come with that. And so the crow in some ways represents this image of death in a way, but death that is leading you out of itself, death that's kind of leading you towards something meaningful. And so you'll see the crow appear for the mother when she dies, finding out that she's going to have this child. And then the crow kind of leads Snow White through her process of being chased away from the castle, going into this moment where she doesn't know what's happening to her, where she in some ways is in her discovering of her own puberty, where she's faced with all the problems of womanhood without all the advantages, you could say, at the outset, where she's dealing with all these little ratty men and all these caricatures of manhood, and she has to learn to work and to do all the chores of a woman, but she doesn't know what this is for. She kind of has to discover what this is for. And so in the story at the end, when the prince meets her and they finally come together, you know, you see an image of a dove appearing to mm-hmm. kind of show this kind of transformation of the crow mm-hmm. into a dove, referencing, of course, the story of Noah.
Wow. Incredible. We are speaking with Jonathan Pageau, the author of a new fairy tale masterpiece, really, is what he's doing. And we're talking about Snow White, the first work that he has completed in this effort to revivify fairy tales. And, you know, you mentioned a little bit earlier that there's some biblical themes that you'll see reflected in some of the fairy tales. So tell us what biblical themes you feel like are the strongest in Snow White.
Yeah. So we are doing this for all the stories. So in some ways, what I'm trying to do is notice in the stories, what are these themes that reflect the Bible, and then trying to make them more salient. There's no explanation in the story. It really is just, we're telling the story, and it's accessible for a six-year-old. But we hope that for the adults, they'll be able to say, I get it. And so in Snow White, right, there's this story about a young girl that eats an apple and dies. Like, we've heard this before, right? What's going on? What's the connection? Why does it look different, and why does it look the same? And so the way that I've kind of structured the story in the text is there to help you understand the connection between Genesis 3, the fall, and this story of Snow White. I don't want to totally give you the answer, because I hope for that grown-ups, when they read it, they will see it. But there is something you could say actually, Snow White helped me understand the Bible story a little more, because there's a very strange thing in Snow White, which is Snow White is the most beautiful. And so then the witch, she goes into the forest, and in the original version, in the version that I'm using, she tries to give her like a beautiful comb, and then like a beautiful corset, and a beautiful belt, a beautiful, the hairpin, I think. I forget the three objects. I changed them a little. But it's like, why is she trying to give her these beautiful supplements if she's already the most beautiful? And then that's the key. The key is that in some ways what she's trying to get her to have is knowledge of beauty, not beauty, knowledge mm-hmm. of beauty. And that's why when she gets it, that in some ways she dies. And we know that because, you know, women, men too, but women especially, who know they're beautiful. And when they know they're beautiful, then it in some ways destroys that beauty, because they use it as a weapon, or they use it as a way to get what they want. And that's what the queen is doing. Right? The queen is using her beauty as a weapon. And so Snow White has to find a way to be beautiful and innocent, or know she's beautiful without it destroying her. Yeah. And that's part of what the story is about. And it connects to this idea of knowledge of good and evil. There's something about that which is dangerous, because it makes you self-aware. And then you also, all of a sudden, then the knowledge of good and evil can be dangerous for you.
Awesome. Tell me about the dwarves. You referenced it, like all of these different sort of, I don't know how to say it, but fragmented aspects of masculinity, or distorted aspects of masculinity. What do the dwarves represent in this story?
I think that they represent several things. One of the things they definitely do represent is what I said, which is that it's like Snow White goes out of the castle into the woods, into the dark place, into the place of transition. It's related to her puberty. It's related to her discovering, you know, becoming a woman. And, you know, it is related to, when she encounters the dwarves, she has to learn to work. She has to learn to clean the house and do all the things that traditionally the women were doing. And then she's with all these, like, especially the Disney got it really right, because it's like dopey and sneezy and like basically like all the side effects, all the like idiosyncrasies of masculinity that would make you not see a mate, let's say, in a man. And so that's what she said. She's basically faced with all of these things about masculinity, which are not attractive, which are not something that she would want to join herself with. And she has to kind of find her way out of that in order to find the true person that would join with her so that she can found a family. Because that's what the story is ultimately about, is about becoming a woman and then becoming a mother ultimately in the end. And so I think Disney got it very right in understanding the dwarves as these kind of strange, you know, kind of stupid and too smart and always angry and always grumpy. It's all of these things that, you know, your dad, you can see characteristics of your dad or your grandfather, of your uncle, you know, when they get older and they kind of lose that, you know, they lose the desire. They don't have that drive that a young man has to join with a woman, let's say.
I'm laughing because I'm such an idiot. I'm like, my mind is like exploding while you're talking, because I'm now starting to see all of these realities that I didn't see before. And even when I read your book, I'm like, oh, this is so beautiful. There's obviously imagery in here. But I'm like, oh, a dwarf. He's not fully a man yet.
That's right. He's a little man.
And I'm laughing as you're talking, because I have two daughters, one that's 21 and one that's 19. And all through high school, they had little dwarves all around them.
Yeah.
And dwarves that wanted their attention. Dwarves that were like, hey, you and I, we should be together. And my daughters had to sift through, he's a bum. This kid lies.
Yeah.
This one obviously wants something from me without being willing to give what I need. And the process of weeding out the dwarves in their lives was very real and took some maturation on their part, you know, to say, well, this guy wants my attention. He's been like driving me home from school a lot. But I don't like the fact that he is always smoking pot, you know, like he is stunted in his, you know, development to maturity. So we've been talking with Jonathan Pageau. Thank you so much. Go to, search his name.
Mogworld.com. Yeah.
Yes. And get this story tale this fairy tale for the sake of you and your kid. We'll be with you and doing Q&A in just a minute.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to Them Before Us Radio. There is obviously a lot to consider when it comes to teaching truths, timeless truths, to our children. I'm so grateful that you as the parent can do that. But then also, we now have these beautiful forms of art, like Jonathan Pageau's new illustrated version of Snow White, that can help us in those pursuits. But sometimes we ourselves have a hard time figuring out, well, what do I do in this situation? And so that is what we are going to do here in the Q&A segment, is we are going to take a lot of these absolute truths and try to apply them to what can often be a bit of a messy situation, and that is the real life situation. It all looks clean and neat on paper, but once you have to apply it to the real life world, sometimes it's hard to figure out what's the right course of action here. So that's what we tackle in the final segment of Them Before Us Radio. And as always, to help me answer your questions that you've sent in over the last week is my training director, Jen Friesen. Welcome back, Jen.
Hey, good to be here. Got some thought-provoking questions for you today. All right. First one is, someone asks, our son wants to bring his girlfriend home for the holidays. How do we hold boundaries around sex and marriage with family coming into town and wanting to stay at our house?
Very, very good question. And I would say, you know, the answer to this question should begin when your children are very young. You are going to have people, hopefully, you're going to have people come and stay with you. You are going to host a variety of different people. Right when you first have kids, you, in my opinion, this is what we did, should establish the rule that nobody who is not married ever sleeps together in a room in your house. Now, this can be very challenging, not just for kids who are coming home with boyfriends and girlfriends, but maybe you have parents who are divorced and now dating somebody that is new, or siblings who are not yet married who want to bring their fiance or their boyfriend or girlfriend over for Thanksgiving or for Christmas, or, you know, because they're in town for the weekend. You need to establish right away at the very beginning of your child rearing process that only married people, and I would even say heterosexual married people, like you've got to be very clear, will sleep together in our house. Now, I have unbelieving family members who are in a variety of different situations. And when my family goes to stay with them, we do not say, hey, you are not allowed to sleep in the same bedroom together. Our children go to those houses, they sleep in those rooms, and they know that, you know, this aunt or this uncle or this sister or this brother, they don't have the same values that we do. But at our house is going to be a reflection of kingdom values. And so even when children are very young and you're not having any conversations about sex at all, they notice something. They notice that married men and women go to the same bedroom at night. Unmarried men and women or same-sex couples that are staying with you never go to the same bedroom at night. And even at a very, very young age, you are teaching them there is a difference in this kind of relationship versus every other relationship. Now, that is going to be very helpful when your kids come home. If, for example, they are making decisions that are out of step with that biblical ethic, and they come home and say, I want to bring my girlfriend home for Thanksgiving, it will not be a surprise to them when you say, okay, we will prepare the couch for you, and you know, your girlfriend will get your old room. And that should not be a surprise. Hopefully you're not going to have that conversation for the first time when they come home from college with their boyfriend or girlfriend. But if you do, and if you haven't had this conversation, you can say, hey, this is the rule for our house. You know, I don't necessarily determine what you do now that you're out of the home. You are now making your own decisions. We continue to try to reflect the biblical ethic in our home. And so if you guys are coming home with us to our house, you're not going to be able to share a room together. Jen, do you have thoughts or advice on this?
Yeah, the only thing that I thought about, and you touched on it a little, is that you should have a consistent rule that applies across. It's not just for your kids, but then you let your brother do what he wants because he's an older adult, right? Or you only wouldn't allow a same-sex couple to shack up sort of at your house, but you would let a heterosexual couple do it. I think those are just to be consistent would be really smart. And yeah, obviously having that just known from childhood on is much better than trying to change it when they're older, but it's still okay to present, hey, this is a value we have, and to make it explicit whenever it comes up.
Yeah. And I will say, I've had those conversations with people that are coming to visit that I'm very close to, and it's very uncomfortable saying, hey, you know, you've been with your same-sex partner for 15 years and you guys have owned a home together. We'd love to have you. I can prepare two different rooms for you. Or same thing with somebody who's dating but not married, that's a heterosexual. Those are, for me, those are very uncomfortable conversations to have, but especially when you have children in the home, this is one of the critical teaching moments, object lessons for your kids about what marriage is. And it is worth having those uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah, it's a great point. All right, number two for today, this was from an email that we got of someone who's a fan of the organization and what we do, but she takes a little bit of issue with focusing so much on stories. She is wondering, isn't that just trying to appeal to emotion like people more on the left side of the political spectrum? If facts don't care about our feelings, why are we using story and the power of story to try to, you know, kind of draw out people's emotions when it comes to a lot of the topics we talk about?
Oh, this is such an exceptional question. And if you have not really dived into our work at Them Before Us, our whole first book, Them Before Us, Why We Need a Global Children's Rights Movement, has about 120 stories of children who have experienced family breakdown. What you're going to see in the articles that we write, in the interviews we give, the stories that we share, we will always, whenever possible, include the stories of children who have been harmed through mother or father loss. It is tactically a decision that we made very early on in the life of our nonprofit. Why is that? Well, people that are arguing for marriage and family throughout the ages have always had natural law on their side. They have always had biblical truth on their side. They have even had great research and good statistics on their side. And yet, we continue to lose cultural battle after cultural battle. Why? Because statistics don't move the heart. The stories do. And so we work very hard at Them Before Us to not just tell the stories of children, but tell the compelling stories of children. When people put their stories on our website, I often encourage them. I verify their identity, but I encourage them to use a pseudonym so they can go into great detail about how they suffered, because we are going to humanize that child and we want to swing your empathy away from the adult and towards the kid. Now, that is not to say that the story or the lived experience, to use sort of the left term for this, is king. We always follow up with incredible research, the studies, and the statistics. But we hook people with story. So it's not only good to humanize the child so we can understand what's really at stake, but it is also tactically smart to pull people in and maybe open their eyes that maybe some belief that they've had that kids are resilient, so you can get a divorce when they're five and it's no big deal. We're going to open their eyes to the fact that, no, there's very real victims here. Maybe they'll consider another perspective. And then we sucker punch them with great data.
Well, it's interesting because of your conversation with Jonathan too, right? Story has always been such a powerful vehicle for truth telling, whether they're fictional or not. And we've talked about how the right has sort of ceded all of the storytelling ground to the other side when it comes, even just think about movies or music. And there's always the big joke within Christian culture, especially the 80s, 90s. It just felt like we're always sort of just behind whatever is cool and cultural, and we're just making sort of these Christian copies of it. I think there's been a good resurgence of good Christian art, but to the point of the question, good storytelling appeals to everyone, no matter what. We're just trying to actually tell stories that are not being told. And if we're doing a good job telling these stories, people will be more open to the other truths that we're trying to talk about.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Okay, final question, pretty broad, but I, you know, with the holidays, and this is still very true for so many people. Someone says, my friend's parents are getting divorced. How can I support him? We don't know, you know, age or whatever, but.
Yeah. So this is very, very challenging. Since the person's asking the question and it's their friend, I am going to assume that this is a young adult, a teen, maybe somebody in their early 20s. And actually what we have seen is divorce rates have somewhat leveled off over the last decade or two, that we're not necessarily seeing sky high divorce rates. And there's some positive news for that in terms of, okay, good. If you are getting married, then these unions seem to be a little bit more stable. The drawback of that news is that the reason divorce rates are down is because marriage rates are down. People simply aren't getting married. And so there's fewer people that have the option to divorce. But there is one demographic where divorce is on the rise, and it's something called gray divorce. People who are more in the retirement years, who are older, who have been married maybe for 25, 30, 35 years, who are getting divorced. And this has become, you know, very notable to the point where we now have people that are trying to study what is going on with the rise of gray divorce. And so we have cataloged some of the stories of the kids who have experienced gray divorce. I personally have talked with a lot of people who are, you know, 40-year-old moms who have three kids, and her parents are now just deciding to divorce. And it's awful. It's absolutely destabilizing. You know, you think, well, it's going to be bad if we divorce when the kids are 6 or 16. And it is bad when the kids are 6 or 16. But get to the point where you're 36 and you've built this world around, these are the values that my parents instilled in me. This is what they've modeled for me. This is the solid rock on which I'm going to model, and I am going to, you know, pattern my family after. And now that model has disintegrated. It is absolutely devastating. And here's the other drawback of this sort of older era of divorce. Now you've got that middle generation, right? The parent who is 35 or 45 or 50, and they're not just caring for their own children at home. They now very often will need to become the caregivers for their own parents. And so they've got two ends, like they are the pillar that is supporting both sides, when really it's supposed to be a little more of a trickle-down effect where the older generations are always doing the more caregiving and shepherding and supporting of the next generation. And so you heap this huge load on these adult children of divorce. So what can you do for a friend like that? Number one, don't dismiss it. Like, I think there's a lot of people that when your parents divorce at 22 or 25, you're like, well, you know, at least they stayed together while you were a kid. Probably not the right response, because this might be a absolute world-shaking announcement that their parents just dropped on them. So recognize that this could have a really significant impact on them. Maybe not their physical health like kids that are in the home, but definitely their emotional health, right? Their idea, their concept of what marriage is and how reliable it is. Validation is always the way to go for this, because there will be a lot of people in your friend's world going, oh, you should just be glad that they stayed together so long. Validate, listen, be the person to which they can tell everything, because a lot of people are not going to want to hear it. There's not a lot that you can do other than that, because obviously you're pretty removed from the situation. But I would say not diminishing the harm is probably one of the best things you can do. Jen, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I love what you're saying. I think listening without thinking about many things you need to say is probably a good rule of thumb. Most times we're listening to someone share about hard things. There was a Brené Brown video where a lot of people start sentences with "at least" to try and do a little silver lining around things. And you can kind of wait on that. We talked about the things where people say, "at least you'll have two bedrooms, at least you'll have two Christmases." You're actually pinpointing the horrifying part of what happens with divorce, right? So I think listening, compassion, being there for that person, you know, especially adults that are in someone's life, a younger person who gets divorced, I think being a constant is a really amazing thing. There's so many folks who invite me to come for different holidays. And thankfully I have a place to go, but there's a lot of folks in my church and such that just see that, you know, I'm single and I don't have kids and my family lives an hour away. They're always just making sure I have somewhere to go. I think that's, those kind of things are really awesome as well.
Well, and your parents divorced when you were somewhat older. And so when you're talking about the people at your church who are providing sort of a stable nearby place, you are in some ways still kind of dealing with the split home challenges of what do I do for holidays here? Dad's house, mom's house. How do I navigate those relationships? I think a lot of the other very serious challenges is just like kids whose parents divorce when they're younger. It's sometimes hard to then watch your 55-year-old mother kind of hit the dating scene again, you know, or your father now, you know, maybe tossed aside your 60-year-old mother and now he's dating a 42-year-old woman. I mean, like it comes, there's a lot of complexities that can come with your parents who are older dating and, you know, breaking up and then pursuing other relationships. There obviously are complications for that if you have children in the home and you have to explain, you know, not only is, you know, we address sort of the son coming home with his girlfriend, but grandma now has a boyfriend that she wants to come and spend Thanksgiving with and share a same bedroom with. So it can be very hard to have those kinds of conversations as well. Since it is the week of Thanksgiving, we want to say, number one, how thankful we are for American Family Radio for extending this opportunity for us to speak to you and give an entire hour of our time and your time to really thinking carefully about all the issues in society that are affecting kids. And we're thankful for you that you've chosen to give your attention to this cause. We hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving week, that the future of the holiday season promises joy and peace for you and your family.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.